episode 83, Patrick and Cyprian speak with returning guest, Dr. Pranaya Narayan of UCLA. The team discuss distributed quantum sensor networks, lasers, magnons, and new technology application opportunities through organic conversations. Welcome to Entangled Things, your quantum computing podcast, hosted by Patrick and Cyprian.
Hey, Cyprian, how you doing?
Hey, Patrick. I'm doing very well. Looking forward for another great episode of Entangled Things.
And you won't be disappointed. Back again, I guess we were on our good behavior last time, is Pri. Pri, can you introduce yourself to the audience again?
Absolutely. Thank you again for having me back here. Pranaya Narayan, I go by Pri. I'm on the faculty at UCLA, where I have appointments in physical sciences as well as in engineering. So I'm maximally delocalized.
Yes, but you, as we were just discussing before, you've been moving around a lot, but for a little while, your wave function collapsed, which
That's
is
right.
very nice. the geekiest joke I've ever made. So what are you up to now? Last time we talked to you, you were on my coast.
Right. Well, I moved across country and my entire group moved as well. So it's a really, really fun and also... a bonding experience for us. We have now set up a pretty big operation here. We're really focused on all three aspects of quantum technologies. I know last time we chatted, there was a lot of discussion, new algorithms, quantum computing. I think a lot has happened since we last talked. In my own group, we've also now branched off into areas of quantum sensing and, of course, using quantum networking as best as we can in both compute and sensing. So
wow.
I'm excited to tell you about all three kind of pillars of quantum technology.
So sensing, we're hearing a lot more about that. It seems to be coming into its own. Is that what aspects are you guys delving into, or is that secret?
No secret, actually. So, turns out that folks have thought about quantum sensors. And by the way, quantum sensors that are in the quantum 1.0 domain have been around for a while. If you've ever, seen or gotten an MRI, that's essentially what's happening there. So what we're now talking about is quantum 2.0 and how you would apply that in quantum sensing. So essentially, how can we leverage a variety of networked quantum sensors? And these are ones where you can think of an individual quantum sensor getting you to very, very precise measurement, but then using a network of sensors to go beyond things like the standard quantum limit. So in quantum sensing, we talk a lot about these rigorous bounds. This is essentially how much information can I extract from a system, from a measurement, how much information can I extract from, say, a certain correlated phenomena, and you can put rigorous bounds. Of course, experimentally, you never get there quite as easily as a theorist would predict, but you have that potential, whereas you can show that, even if I had the best possible classical sensor where every individual component was at its quantum limit, you wouldn't have the ability to go beyond the standard quantum limit. So there's, some interesting stuff to be done there.
You're taking us beyond the old parameters, the new model.
For sure. So, if you compare these to a classical probe, essentially, and it's easiest to see this with light, but there are various ways you can implement it. Essentially, non-classical states of light, using them in metrology, particularly thinking about entangled photon states and squeezed light, is actually a really kind of promising direction, promising area to go. And I can go on about this, but...
And we want to hear you. We have other things to talk about too, though.
Yeah, well, one of the best ways that I explain this in a classroom setting is that qubits are really sensitive to noise, to the environment, right? And that's something that everyone in other aspects of quantum technology wants to get rid of. But that also makes them a really good sensor, as long as you can figure out how to match their sensitivity to the environment with the problem that you're interested in.
Right. So you've taken the most annoying part for people who are trying to build superconducting qubits and trapped ions, and you've turned it into a feature. It's not a bug, it's a feature.
Yep, always. I feel like if you can do that, keep moving the technology forward.
Right.
But I think the applications of quantum sensing are just amazing. One of the applications that I've been discussing with some folks very recently, and it just kind of like blew my mind, is using quantum sensing on improving the sensitivity of the detectors that are used for gravitational waves.
Right.
That one was like mind blowing. And what is exactly what you mentioned, right? Because they reached at a point where, right, with the classical device, there was only so much that they could do. And moving into the quantum realm, apparently the promise there is to get maybe a factor of 10x improvement in terms of the sensitivity of those detectors. Wow. That particular use case just like blew my mind.
It's, you know, quite remarkable how you can get an order of magnitude or many orders of magnitude. And this is improving from a point that is very, very, very optimized, right? So this isn't getting a 10x or 100x where you're still far from the limits. This is really after a decade of amazing instrumentation, how do you get 10x? And this is one of the ways.
I wonder where, and I'm sure somebody knows the answer to this, maybe on this call. We're starting to get to the point where processor technologies are getting into the, you know, nanometer and sub nanometer eventually size, and quantum effects will have a big part of it. And I think there's going to be a meshing of, it's not quantum computing, but it's computing with quantum when we get to the chips where the atoms are the transistors at some point.
Yes. And, you know, when we talk about quantum sensing, particularly of quantum matter or just of materials, that's essentially what we have in mind, right? How do I use these very precise sensors to do seemingly mundane but increasingly harder things like quality control, like understanding where are there improvements in making these devices from a process standpoint? And I knew next to nothing about how these, large scale kind of processes are optimized. At every step, you check what you do, and it makes sense. You don't want to sell a computer that has some defect that you could have detected right at the beginning. But we, you know, as folks in quantum technology, kind of don't often think about that. And once somebody explained that to me, they're like, "Well, can we integrate quantum sensors into the process flow?" And I was like, "Okay, let me think about that." And we've been trying to do that. That's probably the most applied thing that I have thought about.
So the extension of that, based on what I just said too, is I could see your, you know, the sensors, the way you're describing the sensors, as if we had atomic transistors, like we go yep. down to the atomic level, you would need quantum sensing in order to read the data.
You would need quantum sensing in order to actually know you made what you think you we're you going made. To make, and yeah. then to actually interact with the transistor itself. So
wow, yeah. Okay. I said we're still yeah. a ways away from that, but we're heading there, and they are starting to talk about quantum effects in the chip manufacturing and things like that. So sensing is wide open. We certainly could talk about that for a while, but you're doing other things too that we should definitely talk about.
Absolutely. So one of the things that we've been, well, I'll tell you a little bit about this, and then hopefully we'll have some discussion around it too.
Sure.
So we've been thinking about, you know, how you can quantify and understand non-equilibrium effects. This is something on the very fundamental side of what my group works on. And perhaps if there are ways of using non-equilibrium in quantum devices. So this is, If I drive a system, not just slightly away from equilibrium, but very far away from equilibrium, can I use the new states I'm creating in order to actually, do types of computation that you wouldn't be able to do with standard kind of equilibrium behavior? And this has been quite exciting. We just actually put out a handful of papers that appeared in Nature Physics. And those were around a very particular type of excitation we could access, magnons. So essentially spin waves, and driving them and figuring out how that drive allows you to create a few more things. So we coined this whole thing, nonlinear magnetics. We got quite excited about, you know, can you use this for computing? It wouldn't strictly be quantum computing. It wouldn't really be classical. It was this like kind of niche area. So we've been pretty excited about it. And I've been learning as to why historically folks kind of dismiss the idea of using non-equilibrium in compute and how we might bring it back. So,
oh, wow. So when does this also, and I don't mean to confuse things, but I can't remember the name of the ion where it's a really large ion, where it's outside of, it's so far from its base state. And I thought that was something that QERA was using for their experiment. Is it that kind of thing where it's outside of normal equilibrium, or is it, are you looking at those kinds of systems?
You know, how you get out of equilibrium can
many ways.
And that's one way of doing it. In our case, we go kind of the brute force route of shining a giant laser on it. Turns out that hitting something with a lot of light or a lot of electrons is a sure way of throwing it out of equilibrium.
There you go. It works on me all the time.
And we're able to do that, essentially get these magnet modes, not just to be, you know, slightly excited, but actually kind of move them around, do up convergent type processes. And essentially you could think of it as doing nonlinear optics, but with a very condensed matter type excitation, in this case, a magnon. So all these types of things that you could do with photons and areas where you need nonlinear photonics, nonlinear optics in order to actually do compute, you might now be able to do those with magnons. So at least that's what we've put forward. You know, it's far from a device that anyone would sell today, but it's something that, you know, we've shown pieces of this puzzle and we're leveraging some of the terahertz technology that exists in order to actually get this to go. So
but we need people doing this kind of research because that's what brings the big breakthroughs.
You know, it certainly is far from the mainstream.
I just wanted to ask, and pardon my ignorance, right? Are you kind of trying to get some kind of use of the state variables in the non-equilibrium state? That's the approach?
A little bit simpler in this case. We were so far thinking about the pieces of the puzzle that you'd want to come up with that allow mm-hmm. you to get away from optics and replace that with some excitation and condensed matter. Essentially, you know, instead of trying to do operations with photons, can I do that with some other thing? In this case, magnons. Need not always be magnons. And a way to think about it is, you know, we have a lot of options for excitations in different types of quantum matter. And if we could just access them and control them and move them around, there's a lot more we can do. And it overcomes some of the challenges people have from traditional kind of optical scenarios, because you, of course, are able to engineer these interactions. And there are many more interactions that happen. Photons, I love photons. They do everything, but they don't like to interact. This is essentially a way of getting new interactions. So, you know, from a compute standpoint, that would make it easier to implement types of gates, or even if you wanted to do analog simulation, you ought to be able to do it a little bit easier because you have so many more options for how things can interact in condensed matter.
So just for our audience to maybe understand the concept of a magnon, is that something that it's derived from an electron or it's an actual electron?
So, okay, well, when we think about magnons, or, you know, that was a, kind of the concrete example I was giving, mm-hmm. you think of a bunch of spins kind of doing a dance, right? And of course, I kind of describe this a little more as it's either a line dance, or if you're doing slightly more complex things, then it's kind of like the ballet, and you can really get interesting textures to form that are as a result of that excitation. So I can kind of think of many geometric ways of using these as well, which is not something you'd do with photons easily, right? Because everything, everywhere you want photons to go, you'd want to pattern it in a way that that's where they are. In this case, it's recognizing that these excitations have textures that come from the condensed matter, from the material itself that you're using. So I'll send you some links and images to these because they're very exciting and
I can imagine the images are just like mind bending.
It's fun. I never thought of this as a direction we'd go, but you know, to a point that was made earlier, part of the move has been for me to kind of be able to think about exciting and newer directions, higher risk directions than I was working on previously, in addition to the quote unquote usual stuff in quantum technology.
So what would be the end game of this? Like what kind of potential applications this would have? And probably some of them are not even obvious or haven't even been thought of, but like, where do you think this would lead to?
You know, we, at least for some of the non-equilibrium work, have just thought, hey, if you could come up with things that conventional device architectures don't have, maybe you could think of something that is, strictly speaking, beyond von Neumann. If you could think of something that allows you to supplement existing computer architectures, that could be fun. So that's really the motivation. It's not, I don't have a specific roadmap of I'm going to implement this, implement that. This is, like I said, something way more on the fundamental side of what we're doing.
Which is so important nowadays. You got to have that kind of fundamental research or else we'll run out of the innovations down the road.
Right. Well, I wish I could have recorded you saying that. And then I was like, oh, wait, this is in fact recorded. So next time I'm asked, why are you working on this super fundamental thing? I can just play back.
Just point them at me. I'll take care of them. Well, I mean, you know, if you think about it, if you trace back anything, GPS, the internet, almost anything, there was a lot of fundamental science that wasn't chasing a particular outcome like what you're doing. It's fundamental. And what we see is countries that pursue this and fund it have the leg up for decades because they're putting their investments in places for exactly that reason. It's like when you teach kids fundamentals, they don't instantly, you know, learn how to read because you taught them about the letter A, but they're building blocks. And we keep forgetting that.
And that's right. Couldn't agree more. And I'll say that even some of the stuff we're doing that's more applied on the, you know, quantum sensing that we were talking about earlier can be used to understand correlations in condensed matter. In fact, that's something we're doing. We're trying to figure out how you could use quantum sensing to, for example, characterize long-range correlations and very entangled states that you can create in condensed matter. So we've been, thinking about applied stuff and very fundamental stuff. And turns out kind of pushing on both has been rewarding. You kind of find intersections that you wouldn't expect previously.
Yeah. Well, so I forget the name, which company it was. There was, I'm trying to remember. Oh, it was Slack. The company that brought us Slack, they were an e-commerce company that failed. And Slack was a tool they had used and then they marketed that. They weren't looking to build Slack. They built it as a we'll use that to communicate. And then that became their company. And so we find in entrepreneurialism, which, you know, I've built many products and companies and so has Cyprian, that a lot of times you'll build something and you'll learn enough from that to do something more successful or something that is successful. And that's where I see basic fundamental research going. You don't know what you're looking for, but you're going to find something.
Yes. And some of these things also, you know, are a result of who you run into and who you interact with. So I started climbing with a colleague and realized that she works in atmospheric and climate science. And she asked, well, can these sensors be used to actually learn something about the atmosphere and about the environment? And I was like, oh, I say more. I thought that we had the ability to sense everything about the environment. She's like, oh no, there are all these types of species, this, that, and the other thing. And I start to learn from her and immediately realize that this is an opportunity for quantum sensors to shine, including the kinds of distributed sensors that people, you know, are using for high-end metrology, trying to understand the origins and nature of the universe. And, you know, turns out also be helpful if we knew what's in the environment that we're living in right now. And so that ended up now turning into a couple of NSF projects that we got. And
I love those stories of a physicist and a mathematician meet in a bar, and you know they have a conversation about something that neither one of them was thinking about, and they come up with something. Shor's algorithm, for example, it wasn't, if you listen to the story of how he came up with it, there was a series of events that led him down that path. He wasn't looking for that.
Yeah. Well, I was, you know, just looking to learn how to climb a bit better. And now I have a new scientific direction that I'm thinking about.
And you built your grip strength, which is all good things.
Exactly.
It feels to me like, and I would like to get your opinion on this, it feels to me like quantum sensing in general is almost like getting a new boost, probably also fueled by some of the results that were already achieved by folks who were like trying to build quantum communication devices and quantum computers. Is this something that you see also? Because I feel like this is a kind of a circle that, you know, fuels each other.
Absolutely. So, you know, a lot of what is possible with these distributed sensors, remember I said we could have a single sensor, but if you can connect these in a way that you have kind of distributed entanglement, that essentially is enabled by some of the work that folks are doing in quantum networking, right? You wouldn't really be thinking about those types of architectures if folks hadn't figured it out. So, and the only, you know, thing that makes sensors a little easier to kind of see out in the field sooner is that you can get away with just a little more. So you could have slightly less efficient ways of connecting things, and that would still work. And that's something, of course, for people doing quantum networking purely for applications in communication is really, really hard, because I could have some sensors that are you know, really collecting data at the limit, and some maybe that are not quite there. And that's okay, because I can do interesting data fusion, come up with ways of kind of synthesizing information from all of the sensors. But in a communication only scenario, that would be a disaster, right? That would be the equivalent of two people have amazing internet and the other two are trying old dial-up, right?
So in there.
Right. So are you also doing work in quantum communications? Because it feels to me like if you're in sensors, right, then it's almost unavoidable to also be in communications.
Yeah, we think about, you know, how you could do entanglement-based networks. My interest in that is more on the fundamental side. So, you know, ways that you could do entanglement, purification, and distillation, and kind of what's the optimal way of doing this over a network. There's a company that spun out of my group that's kind of gone more the route of how do we deliver parts of this network with, you know, thinking about the stack from a classical networking standpoint, but adopting an architecture that's better for quantum networks. So they've been thinking about, you know, what would a control plane look like? You know, is the standard, and I'm using the word standard, even though everyone in classical networks says SDN is dead, but, you know, what's an SDN for quantum networks? So that's, they've kind of gone that route, and I'm very, you know, involved from a technology direction standpoint. In my own group, we of course work on things that are on the fundamental end of that spectrum, and you know what's coming up next. So when you can think about distributing entanglement in this way, there's really a lot that becomes possible, right? You could think about modular quantum devices. You could think about a stack that is associated with modular quantum devices. So we've kind of started to work on that in my group. And the problems are quite interesting, right? So folks talk about these quantum chemistry problems in a way that you would want to run them on a quantum device that is a single massive device, right? Okay, great. We can all work towards big jumbo devices. But if we end up with something that's modular, how do I, what's the best mapping that is efficient that also uses the modularity and some knowledge, the physical system that you're trying to simulate, right? So we've kind of gone that route, and everyone's trying to show they can do the biggest Hamiltonian that they can find on one of these devices and maybe learn something. It turns out some of the scenarios, heuristics is enough. People have known about these problems for a while, and you might not get a very accurate solution from heuristics, but it's good enough, right? That's good. But then you start to say, okay, at some point I'm going to have big enough devices individually that are connected, and then the numbers really start to look good, right? So from an algorithm standpoint, how am I going to leverage that, and how am I going to leverage that in a way that has its own kind of progression and roadmap. So
cool.
So it is it safe to say that kind of like mastering the entanglement problem is the key to distributed quantum networks and quantum sensing arrays and things like that?
For sure. I think entanglement and thinking about entanglement as a resource, it's the most quantum resource that we could in this scenario use. And I've been trying to, it's interesting, right? So as soon as folks realize entanglement, it's just this like very precious resource. We can control it. We can move it around. Exactly. That's like a mindset thing. And then, you know, in certain classes, folks are like, oh, but I can't even visualize this thing. How do I think of it as a resource? I think of it in terms of some energy metric. I'm like, no, that's not really right. It's like some spatial thing. I'm like, well, it could be spatial, but that's not, again, the right visual. I don't have a visual for it, but I guess somewhere in my mind, I've adopted this abstraction, right? It's a resource. I can move it around. I want to move it around without loss. I want to be able to do optimal things with it. And it seems like you have as well, Cyprian, adopted that visual for it. I'm trying to get more of the field to kind of view it that way and not have their eyes glaze over when you say, oh, there's distributed entanglement.
Yeah. Makes a ton of sense, because actually, on a kind of separate note, but connected to this, one of the things that concerns me when I look at the evolution of various quantum computing modalities, right, is when you think of like massive kind of multi-qubit entanglements, where really currently able, and not sure, I think Quantinuum did the largest one with 32 qubits. I think that's the largest GHZ state that was proven, right? So it feels to me that we're like very, very far from what we're dreaming of with tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and things like that, right? So I feel like fundamental research in this area, right, together with applied research is very much needed if we really want to get that breakthrough, right?
For sure. And it's we don't yet have, you know, algorithms or even ways of intermediate algorithms, I guess is the phrase I'm looking for, that can leverage such architectures, right? We have things that folks have put forward in this NISQ era, and then there are things that folks want to do with a general purpose quantum computer, but there's a lot in between and there's a lot that was not anticipated, right? So I think it's an exciting time to be doing both fundamental and not so fundamental research and more applied research in this domain.
Every month we're surprised by something somebody's trying to do or has done with it, but it is still, it's not marching as fast as we would like, but it's also, it's bouncing around. It seems like it's not a predictable Hamiltonian, if you will.
Yeah. There were roadmaps and everyone said, okay, well, this is going to be, you know, every quarter somebody's going to report something that's on this roadmap, but you see these like really nonlinear improvements and suddenly it's like a step function and then something else in the roadmap seems almost trivially naive, and then you're kind of in a different domain. So, yeah.
What I found with almost everyone we talk to is the thing about quantum is it's very humbling. And we find people who realize that we don't know as much as we thought. And they, and there's that, that means they revise their thoughts about things. So I'm expecting that you don't think about quantum the same way you did a year ago or 2 years ago because of conversations like you had at the climbing gym and things that have, that some of these step functions that you've seen. With that said, you're not, you're dealing with the new lab, the new aspects. We talked about sensing. What else? You said you seemed to indicate there were like three big things in your world right now.
Well, I starting in 2023, actually, took on this role as a U.S. science envoy. That was really prestigious for me to be even asked initially. Actually, I thought, what's going on? Is this real? Is this like some very elaborate prank?
Congratulations. And it's not a prank, I'm sure.
So there are two aspects to it, right? Previously, this role has been around things where science and diplomacy intersect, which typically, you'd have folks in public health, folks working on things like infectious diseases. Rarely would there be someone who is a quantum person, is what I'm saying. I think, in fact, I is the first person in this quantum domain that was named. And I thought that was pretty exciting.
That is very exciting.
Means that there are, you know, folks who are in very kind of traditional roles in the government and doing important work that now think of this as something that we want to be talking about with like-minded allies, something that we want to be engaging with people on and engaging at all levels, right? So scientist to scientist, thinking about how we can have exchange of people and how can we have an exchange of ideas and all work towards kind of growing this ecosystem. So
I think you're an excellent choice for that because our conversations have led me to believe that you think about the future a lot. You have great communication skills. So I think they made a great choice.
So there was, of course, this question of how do we figure out, interacting with students in various contexts, kind of show them that there's a lot of exciting research happening here. That's research they could come visit and go back to where they are, right? Because everyone is kind of concerned about how do we grow the workforce, the pipeline, is at what point in the pipeline are you going to intervene and inject more people, right? So is that at the PhD level? Are we going to suddenly have 10x more PhDs in quantum? Can we bridge part of that with a master's program? So kind of been thinking about that. I made several trips last year and as of this year, I've been asked to stay on in the role. So I'm super, super excited for that. In fact, just planning our trips for this year. But last year, I had a chance to kind of go as a part of the G7, go to Japan.
Nice. And
there are interesting follow-ups from that. So very recently, there was an event here in Santa Monica, actually. It's like 5 minutes from my house, hosted by a combination of the Japanese consulate here, Japan House, and Rand Corp. And they said, let's talk about how we can how we can collaborate and build on some of the interactions that we had last year, right? So it's just interesting how it takes a little bit and you feel like, okay, I met a bunch of people, we talked about a bunch of stuff, what's happening? And then 6 months later, something's happening, right?
Right.
I had a chance to spend a bit of time in both Korea and then Singapore. We're working towards this this interaction with some of the leading institutions in Singapore that have deep quantum technology programs and have for a while. So, kind of figuring out how do we build that connectivity and retain that over time, right? So there are Some of this is, of course, rebuilding post-COVID. So I'm sure more of these interactions existed before COVID, and then it's kind of restarting. But there's an urgency to that restart that I found exciting. And it reemphasizes something that we've all known, that science is, in fact, international. It is, in fact, collaborative. And there has to be collaboration kind of at all levels. It's not, only the faculty or only folks in research institutes, but kind of the students, the postdocs, the junior scientists, the person who is thinking about entering the field, and everyone else. So.
Yeah. Well, if you end up in Romania, you might be dealing with Cyprian, because he's working with the group that's doing quantum communications project. So this, it's all over the place. There's great stuff happening everywhere.
I was just wondering, right? You being the first, as you mentioned, being the first from the field of quantum, would you say this also is kind of an expression of the recognition that quantum is starting to gain more and more? I mean, a recognition of how important it is, of how critical it might become at all levels. Because I certainly feel like in the past years, we see more and more awareness, right? And we see at all the levels, including the public level, right?
Right.
Would you think we as a society are starting to really grasp the importance of this field and how critical it is for our future?
For sure. I think the, folks in policy, people who certainly had no exposure to quantum in their training are recognizing this as an important area. And you'll start to see, and this is already happening, that various science technology agreements we have with various countries explicitly call out quantum, call out aspects of not just, and quantum, but there is within quantum, there are areas that are covered and explicitly discussed. And that's new. I think it was all kind of in this deep tech and compute kind of bucket previously, and now folks are talking about it explicitly. We here at UCLA recently had this quantum innovation hub that was announced, and that was exciting. The governor was here, and it was a really, really fun time to be in this field. And students kind of look at that and say, oh, I don't have to now explain to my parents that I'm working on some weird esoteric thing, because they know that, if every politician wants to talk about this, then it must somehow be important.
Good job.
Not to be confounded with wizardry, right? Or magic.
Or maybe it should be. Maybe it should be.
Well, entering the field, I always had to explain to my extended family what I work on. And it was always a little bit of an awkward conversation. They're all, I'd say reasonably technically inclined, but they'd be members of the family who say, oh yeah, I'm doing this, and this is going to cure cancer or something. And then I would be like, so I've been working on this theory thing and coming up with new algorithm, and I published a paper. And that's when the conversation would politely get turned by some aunt into, oh, that's great. How's the athletic stuff going?
So just tell them, you tell them, but you have to kill them, and then leave it at that. And then when they see you're traveling, they'll be like, I see. Okay.
Well, now I feel like they're, coming out of the woodwork to ask me. So this quantum thing, is there a good article I could read that's at my level?
I know a podcast.
I know. That's my answer is, well, there are a lot of resources, a lot of people trying to communicate this. So, yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, we're coming up on 40 minutes. We could go on for all day. Is there anything we should mention before we go, before we wrap up? Because I know you got your hands in a lot of pots. That last one is a big one. Anything else we're missing?
Well, if you haven't heard yet, 2025 will be an International Year of Quantum. and the APS and various other societies are gearing up for it. So you'll start to see a bunch of programming, and I would love to have people engage. You know, so this is literally a bring your friends, bring your grandma, bring your cousin's cousin type scenario, because we'd love for everyone to know that this is happening. Some of us have been going to various high schools and even middle schools and talking about this. And
We should plan an episode around it, and we should try to get you in before then as well, because we love talking to you.
Thank you. And it's really been fun being back on Entangled Things.
Yeah, the initial briefing is so much shorter now, right? Well, it's wonderful to talk to you again. Does this mean that like you're going to settle in Missouri by the time we talk to you again? Because you keep bouncing coasts, or you're staying in California for a while?
I don't intend to move for a while after this.
It's traumatic.
You're a change of transient. So
yeah, that's a traumatic change.
I think my dogs like it here too. They've embraced the California weather.
Yeah, that's the most important thing as dog people. We know. Well, it was great talking to you. I hope to talk to you again soon. And thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Bye, everybody. We'll talk to you next time.
Bye, everyone.